Okay, just a little commentary on this passage from Matthew. As we've seen over and over, the four Gospels are by no means histories of Jesus, and this is not a historical account either. Remember Joseph from the Hebrew Bible, Joseph the Dreamer, he was called. You know, Joseph with the many-colored coat, and Joseph in the well, and Joseph Pharaoh's secretary, and all this other stuff. And all this happened to Joseph the Dreamer. So we get Joseph the Dreamer again in a modern version of the life of Jesus. So you don't have to worry about Mary's biology, you know, in this thing. This is much of the infancy narratives, both from Luke and Matthew, the only two who have infancy accounts, are a kind of embroidered, a tapestry of themes from the Hebrew Bible. You know, the Lucan theme of poverty, the primacy of poverty, all through Luke. So who does Jesus first manifest himself to? The scum of the earth. Shepherds were bums. You know, we get all the nice Christmas cards, other little cute robes and little sheepies, and you know, they were bums. You only got to be a shepherd if you couldn't flip burgers for whatever the first century version of McDonald's was. They were crooks. They're the outlaws. Who'd want to sit on a hillside in a freezing winter night watching a bunch of smelly sheep? That's not a prime job, you know. He will not sell on Wall Street or Bond Street or any place else, you know. So it fell to the low. So these guys are, what am I getting at? These guys are making religious, theological points. So we get a poor guy or a bunch of poor guys receiving Jesus in a shed, in a cattle shed, for God's sake, you know. So the whole business of the infancy narratives is occluded with, occluded is not the best word, is permeated by all these Old Testament themes and the regular thing. Don't worry if Jesus wasn't born in Bethlehem, which he probably wasn't. He's probably born in Nazareth. Don't worry about all that stuff. But Bethlehem was the city of David. Jesus is his prime, descendant of David, you know, King David. And the other thing I would warn you about with Christmas, which is a dizzying, dazzling time, source of some of the greatest music, however, that's ever been written, in my view. When you hear all these words, glory, we're going to sing glory, 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 all over the place. We have to make this mental adjustment. What's glorious about Jesus? That he wiped the disciples' feet, washed the disciples' feet. That he died without complaint. You know. That's what glory consists in. Not our chintzy Walmart view or Bonwit Teller view of what glory is. So you have to really be very careful to make that mental switch in your head. To see what really is glorious. And that brings me to the fourth Sunday of Advent, the missing God. Where is God most missing in the world, do you think? It's an honest question. So you can all reflect on it for a minute or so. Where is God most clearly missing, absent? Well, as always, I'm happy to take a cue from Francis of Rome, the Pope, not the lady who was canonized as Francis of Rome. He said there is less love in the world. I don't know whether he did a statistical survey or that was just observation. I don't think it would be a casual observation for him because he had enough experience of slums and wars and mayhem of all sorts. And he said there's less love in the world. He's talking about today, not talking about 2,000 years ago. So that's the clearest sign of God's absence. Syria, Palestine, the Congo. The list is endless. You know, talk about a love-free environment. But that doesn't get us very far. Because of all the words in English vocabulary, I think love is the most plastic. Love is a waxen nose. You can make love mean anything. Anything you want. You know? Love can be anything. Love often is, at least in my experience, disguised and barely disguised selfishness. So that I love you best translates as I need you. And that out of that need comes envy, jealousy, divorces, wife beating, you know, all kinds of nasty, nasty stuff. So that's love. No, that's not love. Clearly that's not love. So what is love? What's the paradigm for love? Creation. God did not have to create. As I said a few weeks ago, creation is an act of sheer generosity, sheer self-giving. It doesn't count the cost. It's not looking for a cost-benefit analysis. Well, if I do this, then I'll get this. You know, the way I operate most of the time. If you love me, you never treat me this way. Well, I don't know about that. So what are we left with? Well, we're usually, I think, we're left with a criterion of judging phony love from true love. All of our love is infected with self-seeking, I think, in my experience, and everybody else's experience that I'm familiar with. Love is inseparable from self-aggrandizement in some way or other. Psychic support, or whatever the most recent psychobabble will have it. So how do you describe the love of God? Pure giving. Years and years ago, a few years ago, it finally dawned on me what love in the divine plan was all about. It is love that is self-emptying. It is love that does not look for reward. It is, in a word, love that lets the other be. That's what creation is. God let the other be. And left the other, of course, either to able to respond to that kind of love, which we never see or rarely ever see, even vestiges of. Or we have love as a bargaining, you know, I'll do this for you, you do this for me. Which is utterly foreign to the divine order of loving. Love gives room to the other to be. That sounds nice. Sounds pat and pleasant and promising. But then you have to move the question further. What does it mean for me to let my sons, in my case, be? And here I draw a blank, or pretty much nearly a blank. I think I know what they need to be. But that counts for very little, you know? I think, at least in my experience, it counts for very little. You don't put cyanide in their soup. Okay, we have certain outer limits which we don't transgress. But when you get to the particularities of the mystery of another human life, a mystery which is impenetrable, we are impenetrable to ourselves, and certainly the other is impenetrable to us. And this adds an extraordinarily vital dimension to loving. What we think is loving must always be provisional. I hope this is loving. I hope this lets you room, gives you room to be. And the damnable step is to say, I don't hope, I know this is what you need. This is what you need, period, full stop. Forget it. You know? But that's what love is. You know? So we always, I think, and it's a lesson I learned late and bitterly, that I don't know what is necessary to let another human being be themselves. I've seen many mistakes that I have made, and maybe the promise of some real loving, but I'm always uncertain, and you have to be uncertain, I think. God is the only one who knows what is good for the other. You know? God alone can judge that. And we puny human beings, steeped in mediocrity, I think, as most of us are most of the time, had to be extremely careful in judging what is the loving thing to do. You know, we don't smother them in their cribs. That's a start, but that doesn't get you very far. You know, it doesn't get you very far. So, that's what Christmas is about. It's a celebration of unbounded, unconditional love. It drives me crazy when I hear people say, oh, I love unconditionally. The hell you do, pardon the language. You don't. There are all kinds of hidden conditions here. You know that as well as I do. As soon as you introspect for half of a minute, I will love you if, you know, as long as, until. Nobody loves unconditionally but God. And we flatter ourselves and do vast injustices to ourselves. I say, oh no, I love unconditionally. You don't love unconditionally. And all you have to do is look at the history of love, either in your own biographies or in world history, wherever we see the great loves, to see how tainted they are, how imperfect they are. Regardless of how much goodwill you bring to the effort, and I think I brought a fair amount of goodwill to the effort with my sons, there is no direct cause-effect relationship here, you know. And we think, oh, I've done all this for you, and this is the thanks I get? You know, sound familiar? Love is essentially conditional for us, which is all right. That's all we are. We are finite. But it makes all the difference in the world between certainty and uncertainty. For every act of loving is a kind of trial balloon. That's hard to take. That's hard to take because we're immersed in baloney, BS about love. You know, the culture is full of it. Christmas, we're going to suffocate on it, along with too much stuffed pudding and turkey. But we have to keep our... God wants truths. God is the God of truth. God wants truth. Truth is very hard to come by, in my experience. So, we look for what is missing. So it calls us to examine ourselves, our attitudes, the nature of our relationships with our kids, with our friends, with everybody, and try to make do as best we can, knowing that our efforts are always feeble, imperfect, incomplete. And this is not a counsel of despair. Everybody, I'm tired of people saying, oh, Trojak, you're so morose, you're so melancholy. Slavic melancholy is part of my genetic makeup. I grant you that. But I can see Irish melancholy, French melancholy, German melancholy, Czech melancholy, Polish melancholy, Chinese melancholy. I've taught enough Chinese students who've come to me with these terrible problems with their families, who always know what is best for these kids. So that's all. This is an offering of a caution. That's all. Which is basically good news, because on the other side of our imperfection, there is a God who does will us into being and becoming as our own human perfection, which is in God's hands, not ours.